One of the most remarkable aspects of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. In the Doctrine and Covenants, section 109, verse 7, the Lord commands, "Seek ye diligently, and teach one another words of wisdom. Yea, seek ye out of the best books words of wisdom. Seek learning even by study and also by faith." Today in the Mormon Channel studio, we are joined by Kenneth and Audrey Godfrey, historians and co-authors of By Study and By Faith, The History of the Church Educational System. Welcome to Legacy.
Thank you.
Please, if you would, take a moment and tell our listeners about yourselves and what brought you to this project.
Well, I've always been interested in history. I got the love of history from my father. I always thought he was born with one leg in the 19th century and one in the 20th. And all through the years, I've written histories about and poetry about my family, where I grew up, and then I got a scholarship to Weber College, and it was in journalism, and I was the journalism editor there. And then when I got to Utah State, I had a KSL scholarship and changed over to speech for a while, but then I got back on track on history and got my degree, though, in English. And then 30 years later, went back and got my master's degree in history. And all along that time, I've been writing historical things.
Very good. Brother Godfrey.
Well, my own experience with the history of the church is my father was not well-educated, but he really liked the doctrines and history of the church. And he was the kind of man that wasn't afraid of exploring all avenues of a topic, and when we would come home from church, he would go over the lessons, and we were able to respond to things we had learned. And I, even from a little boy, I was fascinated by the doctrines of the church and the teachings of Joseph Smith. And but I also liked political science and politics and those sorts of things. So I got my bachelor's and master's degree in political science, studied that a little bit also at the University of Southern California. And then in the middle of my graduate school experience, I decided I was going to stay with the church education system, that I was not going to leave it unless they forced me out of it. And I also decided that if I was going to stay in it, I wanted to really be good at something within the church educational system. And so I changed out of political science, went to Brigham Young University, and got a doctor's degree in the history of religion. And one of the emphases was LDS church history. And that started my long love affair with the history of the church.
Well, let's talk about the history of education in the church. Seems almost like a dichotomy that the church started out with a young boy who was not very schooled, shall we say. And yet, from the very beginning of the church, we have had a major emphasis on education. Let's talk a little bit about early church education.
Well, Joseph Smith might not have been highly educated, but somehow he was born with an innate interest in all kinds of things. In fact, Hugh Nibley wrote in an article that if Joseph Smith had not been martyred, he probably would have become a great scholar. When he began to study Hebrew, he just couldn't get enough of it. And he was a good student. His teacher said how quickly he learned. And so Joseph, I think, was like a lot of individuals on America's frontier. They were not exposed to a really good education, and as a result, they became self-educated. There are a lot of early leaders of the church that fit in the same category as Joseph Smith, people like Charles Penrose and Orson Pratt and Parley P. Pratt, who basically educated themselves, and even though they don't have formal degrees, they still have this great love of learning, and at the same time, they had this spiritual dimension. And I'm not sure we can over-exaggerate the influence of the translation of the Book of Mormon on Joseph Smith in an academic way. It just really impacted him. And then to have all of these heavenly visitors meeting with him and instructing him, he was getting an education that was probably a lot better than a lot of us get from from college professors because of the kind of individuals he was encountering all along the way that were teaching him.
I think his family was a great help to him, too. When he would have his visions and experiences, he would come home. And when he was translating, he would come home and share those with the family. And so it was an enriching thing for all of them, too. And, of course, Emma Smith had had some education, and I think she was probably an influence in helping him also.
So what were some of the early educational endeavors by the church in, let's say, Kirtland and Missouri and Nauvoo?
Well, every place the church members gathered and had a core of a people, one of the first buildings that they would construct, even though they were modest in nature, were schools. And in each of these schools, regardless of what was being offered in a secular way, they also managed to incorporate some of the teachings of the church in these schools. So but beginning in Kirtland, not only did you have common schools for the youth of the church in Kirtland, but you also had the School of the Prophets, which was taught by Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon. And you had the School of the Elders that was taught by Parley P. Pratt in Independence, Missouri. It's even said he taught in his bare feet because he didn't have shoes, apparently, at that time. And so there right from the beginning was always this emphasis on education. They took it very seriously. In fact, there was one class that was in Missouri that was taught by John Murdoch, who apparently the students were not taking the class very seriously, and Brother Murdoch got after them, and the students got after him for getting after them, and they went to the school authorities, and Brother Murdoch was tried in a church court for what had transpired in his class. And it isn't so much, it isn't important so much as to the content of the actual trial as it is to observe how seriously Latter-day Saints were taking education even back in the Missouri period. And Brother Murdoch had to apologize to school authorities for losing control of the class, and things were much better after this hearing took place. And so there was, right from the beginning, this great emphasis on education. And they even had a Hebrew school in Kirtland. And the prophet was that they hired a man who spoke and read Hebrew, who was a professional teacher. And Joseph Smith was a student in this Hebrew school, as were many of the early brethren. And they took their education seriously. In fact, there's an account where Orson Pratt and Joseph Smith got into a fairly vigorous discussion as to the correct pronunciation of a Hebrew name, and they went at it quite vigorously, and they were excited, and they were really going at each other on the pronunciation of this word. And the head of the school once said that Joseph Smith was just like a calf that had sucked two cows dry and still wasn't full.
Go ahead, Sister Jeffrey.
Well, I was just going to say, I think we think of them maybe as being on the frontier, but there were learning opportunities. There was a Western Reserve College near Kirtland, and converts coming from England who were educated. And so they're not in a vacuum of not having opportunities.
Very good. Did anything change in a major way once they came out west? Was there a different emphasis or setting for education in the church?
Well, I think the fact that there were more Latter-day Saints here and had to change the church's emphasis on education just a little bit, because you had to provide schools. They settled here. They stayed longer. And so the schools became more sturdy and not so temporary. And in that case, there was a little bit of difference in terms of the church experience and education. But at the beginnings, there were a lot of things that were similar. In fact, I think Audrey has a case of, who was it, George A. Smith teaching mm-hmm. in Cedar City? Maybe she can tell that story.
Yeah, I was just going to mention some of the schools. Before that, though, Brigham Young urged people to bring books with them when they crossed the plains. And still there were, you know, the materials weren't very available. But George A. Smith, well, first let me tell you the first school in the Great Basin. This opened in October of 1847, just 3 months after the first group arrived. It was held in a circular military tent in Salt Lake City. The school was taught by a 17-year-old Quakeress, Mary Jane Dilworth, who had been set apart to teach children by Brigham Young. Her sister, Maria Dilworth, described the first day of school. "My sister called us and said, 'Come, children, come. We will begin now.' There were just a few of us, I think only 9 or 10. One of the brethren came in and opened the school with prayer. I remember one thing he said. It was to the effect that we be good children, and he asked God that the school would be blessed, that we all should have his holy light to guide us into all truth. The first day, Mary Jane taught us the 23rd Psalm, and we sang much and played more." And I thought as I read that, the school epitomized the view of education by church leaders, because they were blessed by the priesthood, they were guided by gospel principles, and they were taught the scriptures. And then as far as George A. Smith's little school, this was in Parowan. And I should mention that a lot of schools were held in pretty rough places. A lot of saints had built dugouts for homes, and some of these were used as schools. One school was held in a dark cellar. Many were too small for the number of the students, and this is what George A. Smith said. "My wickiup is a very important establishment composed of brush, a few slabs, and 3 wagons. A fire in the center and a lot of milking stools, benches, and logs placed around, 2 of which are fashioned with buffalo robes. To see my school some of the cold nights in February, scholars standing round my huge campfire, the wind broken off by the brush, and the whole canopy of heaven for covering, and the thermometer standing at 7 degrees.
My, oh my.
That's a marvelous description, by the way, of a man who really believed in education and that all this was important. Mm-hmm.
So as I understand it, public schools started in Utah, and the church's answer for public schools was these church academies that they mm-hmm. built so they could teach not only religious but secular as well. What became of the academies?
Well, maybe we ought to back up and tell a little bit about the background of the academies.
Good. Thank you very much.
The common schools maybe too.
As the history of Utah started to evolve, the church was behind almost every school, or an individual who was interested in education would form his own school, like Carl G. Mazur in the Second Ward. After he arrived from Germany, he just organized a school because he'd been a teacher in Germany. And there were many individuals that did that. Well, after Utah achieved its territorial status and as time went on, there were laws passed that the different communities had to have schools. And in these schools, because there's a separation of church and state, they were not allowed to teach religion in those schools, which made some of the leading authorities of the church a little uneasy because they didn't want – remember, the title of this book is By Study and Also By Faith. They didn't want an overemphasis on the study and underemphasize the faith part. Now, this wasn't so much an issue in some of the smaller communities because in the smaller communities, members of the church controlled the school board, hired the teachers, and they could hire faithful Latter-day Saints in the classroom. But it became more of an issue in the large cities like Ogden and Salt Lake City. And especially in Salt Lake, the headquarters of the church, there were large numbers of non-church members. And there was a fear that if the schools got in the hands of individuals like this, that they could weaken the church. And then some of the Protestant churches began to look at Utah and were uneasy about what they perceived as the way the church controlled the politics of the area. And so they sent out missionaries who were highly educated, and they organized Presbyterian schools, Methodist schools, Episcopal schools in many of the communities. In fact, in Cache Valley, which is located in the northern part of Utah, there were 18 Protestant schools at one time attempting to attract Latter-day Saints to their classrooms. And in response to all of this, President Wilford Woodruff sent out a letter to all of the stake presidents in the church at that time and asked that they organize academies. And academies were more like grade schools with a little bit of high school education involved, and as well as some teacher training. And so in each of the stakes, there were organized academies. The blessing of the academies is that you could teach secular subjects and you could also teach the doctrines of the church and the scriptures of the church. And so throughout the church then you have this huge influx of academies. Now, teaching in an academy was not always pleasant. Heber Snell was sent to the Bighorn Basin to teach and be the principal of that academy. In the spring of the year, he canceled all of the dances that the academy had been sponsoring, which raised the ire of all of the students. In fact, they boycotted his classes for a time, and they finally their parents made them return to the classroom. But they even threatened Heber Snell's they threatened bodily harm on the principal. And he started to carry a gun to class just in case things got out of hand. But he didn't like carrying a gun to class, and so he went to the patriarch, the stake of patriarch, and got a blessing. And the patriarch told him that his life would be preserved. He would not be killed in the Bighorn Basin. And Brother Snell had enough faith that he stopped carrying the gun, and gradually things settled down, but anyway, that was one of the experiences he had. And
sounds like the makings of a great new seminary film to me. But with these academies, it seems like with the influx of members of the church growing rapidly, that it would be quite an expensive endeavor.
Well, that was one of the problems, is raising money, especially in the, even prior to the academies, wards would be assigned to open schools and to raise money, not necessarily tithes, but they were just to, I'm not sure what the term was, but it was mostly local, as I understand it, that they would have to raise their own money for these schools.
And was it finances that eventually caused the abandon of the project?
Right. A lot of Latter-day Saints We had a depression or a mild recession in 1893, which in the United States, there was also that also affected Utah. And there were some church members that thought it was inappropriate that they be taxed to support public schools, and then they also had to support these church academies. And so they were getting taxed twice. And even though they had testimonies of the gospel and were faithful, they believed this wasn't fair, that they ought to be able to work something out so that you didn't have two school systems that were running parallel to each other. And as this became more serious and more of a challenge to support academies as well as public schools, then there began to be members of the church that began to look a different way to introduce a type of system that where you could teach religion and still meet the requirements of the law. And so that leads us to 1912, when Joseph F. Merrill was serving in the presidency of the Granite Stake. He was a well-educated man, and in fact, I think he was the first Latter-day Saint to earn a doctor's degree from an Eastern university. He was a very good student, and he was amazed one as he and his family conducted family home evenings. As you will remember, in the Granite Stake, that was the church at this time. Joseph F. Smith had initiated a policy of having family home evenings. The Granite Stake was one of the first to implement this policy. They actually produced a family home evening manual, and so Brother Merrill and his wife and children were holding family home evenings, and Sister Merrill was teaching the lessons, and she was really good at it, and she could get the kids into the scriptures and get the scriptures out of the kids as they were in this family home evening. And one evening, as Brother Merrill tells this story, he said he just said to her, "How do you do this? How did you get all of this knowledge?" And she said, "Well, I'm just copying my religion teacher in the academy where I was educated." And then as a result of that, Brother Merrill went to stake leaders and said there ought to be a way for us to give some religious training to our young people at the high school. And the stake president said, yes, there ought to be. So he went to the school leaders, and they allowed him to, as a kind of a pilot program, that they would release the students for 1 hour a day. And he secured a building, and they hired a teacher, and they began to have daytime religious education, which was much cheaper over the long run than, well, even over the short run than having an academy. But the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve were always, they emphasized to Brother Merrill that this was an experiment, and that this was not established church policy, that we would have one of these in every stake. They wanted to take their time and see whether this would work or not. Maybe they were concerned whether young people would actually take time from school to have another class and to study the gospel. But that leads up to the beginning of the seminaries in the church.
So what was this first seminary teacher like?
He was an engineer.
Had to be just one guy. So.
Yeah. He was an engineer, and according to the qualifications that Carl G. Mazur, who was by this time the principal of the Brigham Young Academy and the most famous educator in the church, he said he had to be a man that loved young people, that could inspire young people, that could stimulate them, that could draw them to him, and apparently Brother Yates fit the bill. He would work as an engineer, or I guess he started to teach his seminary classes and then would get on his horse and ride to his duties as an engineer. It had to do with water engineering. And he did all right. The kids responded. I believe there was almost 100 that enrolled that first year, and the state presidency was pleased with the number that came and stayed. And little did they know, those first students, what they were involved in. We recently learned that President Eyring's mother was in that first seminary class, and so we're not very far removed from those early seminary pioneers.
That's right. It was an evening with the General Authority for Religious Educators that President Eyring told that story. Very touching how he says, because of that seminary class, millions of people across the world have been influenced. So very, very interesting. The church officially must have thought it worked out well, as well as the granite stake, because seminary took hold.
When you read it in its entirety, it's slower than you would think, and there are more discussions about it than you would think. There were still members of the church, including church leaders, who felt that academies worked. They'd had a history, and in fact, even David O. McKay had been the principal of the academy in Ogden, and he had strong feelings about the good that the academy had done. And when the Brethren, for economic reasons, decided to stress seminaries, there was still some opposition because seminaries did not have a history or a track record. They didn't know whether those would work or not. The main thing that seminary had going for them was the fact that they were so much cheaper than having an academy. If you build a seminary building adjacent to a high school, it doesn't cost nearly as much to give a religious education to a Latter-day Saint young person than if you have to build a whole academy. And so eventually, in the early 1920s, Elder Adam S. Bennion, who was the superintendent of church schools, later became member of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles. You read through his correspondence and the meetings of the Church Board of Education, and they finally concluded that that for economic reasons and the fact that seminaries, the ones they'd had, were proving to be effective, the church finally decided they would go with seminaries and phase out the academies, give them to the state if the state would accept them. And Utah was very good at that. That's how Snow College came to be Snow College. Dixie became to be Dixie College, and then later a university, and Weber becomes Weber State.
Today in the Mormon Channel studio, we are joined by Kenneth and Audrey Godfrey, historians and co-authors of By Study and By Faith, The History of the Church Educational System. I just want to take a quick detour on this list that I have in front of me. You mentioned a couple of names that I see on this list. This is a chronology of the administrators of church education. And just looking at this list makes you know that church education really means a lot to this church. So I'll just say a couple of these names, Carl Mazur, David O. McKay, John A. Widsoe, Ernest Wilkinson, Neil A. Maxwell, Jeffrey Holland, Henry B. Eyring. There were other great men other than those who oversaw the program. And I want to talk about how Institute got started as well, and specifically talking about J. Wiley Sessions.
Well, that's exciting. After the academies were done away with, there were pockets of Latter-day Saints that began to go to secular colleges. And there was a group of Latter-day Saints that were attending the University of Idaho in Moscow. And they petitioned the leaders of the church and said, their parents did. We send our children to the University of Idaho, and they're in secular classrooms all day long. There is no church service for them on Sunday. and we're afraid we're going to lose them. And so J. Wiley Sessions was a man who had just returned from being president of the South Africa mission. And so when he returned, President Grant let him know that they were going to give him a position in the Utah-Idaho Sugar Company. So he shows up for an interview with President Grant and his counselor, Charles W. Nibley. And as the interview takes place, Brother Nibley suddenly says, Brother Grant, we're making a mistake. Brother Sessions isn't to be receive a position in the Utah-Idaho Sugar Company. We need to send him to the University of Idaho. And this, I think Brother Sessions writes that his heart just kind of sunk. He said, you mean you're going to send me on another mission? I've just been 7 years doing this. And they said, oh, no, this isn't a mission. This is a wonderful opportunity, and you'll thank us for this in the long run. So they sent him to the University of Idaho, where he made friends with the president of the university, and he ended up starting the first institute of the church. The church financed a building. It was large enough that the students could live in the top of it. And this was the beginning of some kind. This is 1926, and there was a movement in the United States for some a cooperative movements and those sorts of things. And Brother Sessions Institute went so well and was doing so much for the students, even having them live on campus, that it was written up in some national magazines, and the president of the university indicated that it was the most successful program he'd ever seen. And the students came to classes. The first classes had to be acceptable to the university and had to be taught in a non-sectarian way, and so they were had more to do with ethics and good Christian living than with actually teaching the scriptures of the church and Book of Mormon. But students responded. Their testimonies of the gospel grew. Their parents were pleased, and just shortly after the University of Idaho Institute became a success, they started one on the campus of Utah State University in Logan, and then they spread to campuses where there are Latter-day Saints enrolled in schools.
We're visiting today, for those listeners who are just joining us, with Kenneth and Audrey Godfrey, historians and co-authors of By Study and By Faith, the history of the church educational system. Let's move on a little bit here. It seems like by the 30s, perhaps, there were quite a few seminary teachers, and they had to be trained. There had to be some sort of way to make the teaching uniform. And so how were they being taught?
Over the history of the church education system, the leaders have always attempted to train seminary teachers and institute teachers to make them better, more effective in the classroom, able to reach students and change their lives. And they've always had these extensive in-service training programs. And so there was an attempt, they used to call it the Aspen Grove experience. They'd bring all of the full-time teachers in the summertime to Aspen Grove, where it was on their break, and they would have teacher training and training in the scriptures. And there were some times in the early 30s where they brought in Edgar Goodspeed, who was considered to be the world's top New Testament scholar, and made a translation of the New Testament, and he gave lectures to these teachers, and they would learn all they could about the background of the scriptures. When President Widsoe became the commissioner of education, he participated or was involved in some of these experiences, and then he had one summer in which he said that he was going to teach all of them. Brother Widsoe had a doctor's degree from university in Germany, but he was more than that, a member of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, and so he taught them the doctrines of the church. And some of the sessions were even held in Salt Lake Temple so that they could talk about some things that pertain to temple work in that holy setting. And then one of the most famous of all of the summer schools, some of the leaders of the church had felt that maybe some of the teachers were getting a little further away from the essential to doctrines of the church than perhaps they should be. And so President J. Reuben Clark, who had only been in the first presidency of the church for about 4 years, 4 to 6 years, he gave a talk which is called the Chartered Course, was been named the Chartered Course in Church Education, in which he called the teachers of the church to return to the fundamental principles of the gospel and teach the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, as well as the Bible, and teach it in its historical setting, but don't apologize for Joseph Smith being a prophet of God. And since that time, that talk's been President Marion G. Romney gave it word for word to another gathering of seminaries and institute teachers. And
well, I was just going to say, too, the curriculum that's printed by the central office is a real guide to how to teach and some ideas. And I know especially for those who began home study overseas that one of the difficulties was getting materials translated and sent to them, and so they kind of had to make up their own for a while. But I think that's probably, and that's changed through the years. Each few years, there's another emphasis, it seems like.
You talked a few minutes ago about J. Reuben Clark's The Chartered Course talk that he gave back in the 30s. And from the excerpts that I've heard, he mentions in there that we, for the youth of the church, we don't have to sugarcoat anything. They want the real doctrine. They want it like it is.
Can I just go on with that a little bit? In 1969, they started seminaries in England, the Scandinavian countries, and so forth. And that's one of the things that I was struck with as I had read some of these histories of these various places, and I want to just tell you a few of those. In Finland, she took early morning seminary, a 17-year-old girl. She and a classmate had carried on a feud for some time. But after a lesson, a seminary lesson, the girl went to her enemy and tried to talk to her, showing her love and how to act as a good friend. This resulted in the former enemy attending seminary, and after a little while, two more girls of the same age got interested and became active also. Now, young people in Europe were surrounded by immorality, not just sexual, but pressure to be dishonest in their grades, cheating on tests and such. And so one of the teachers was trying to teach them to be honest for the sake of honesty. And he asked them if they would cheat on a test, and many of them answered yes. And he said it's pretty hard for them to harmonize what they consider to be Western in the sense of American cultural notions, not religious doctrine, and applying them to their own situations. But a couple of other examples of how they were able to do this. The church sent CES missionaries to Mongolia in the early 1990s. And some years later, Brother Ross Cole was visiting some of these classes. And he asked how many of them had been members of the church for a year, and only four of them had. And the rest had not yet reached that mark. And he asked them how many had a testimony of the Book of Mormon, and every student raised their hand. Brother Cole wondered how they could have a testimony without reading the book. Then a boy about ninth grade raised his hand and said, "We don't have the Book of Mormon or all of it written out, but I have studied some of the verses my teacher has given us. It's kind of like cake. If you take a bite of cake and you like it, you know the whole cake is going to taste the same way, and it's all good. I have had that experience with the Book of Mormon. I've read some scriptures, and I've prayed about them, and I have felt the value of their teaching. I feel like it lifted my soul. I think that's what a testimony is. So, yes, I do have a testimony of the Book of Mormon." And there are many stories like this of young people who are touched by the lessons they receive.
Wow. Even with early morning seminary, that still doesn't work for some students. Mm-hmm. So there has to be another program. What can be done for them?
Well, William E. Barrett, when he was administrator of the seminaries and institutes, began to worry about that himself, especially if you have people who don't have enough of a cluster in their ward of friends or the distance is too far away that they can even participate in an early morning or in a daily seminary program. And as he began to worry about this, he said he had a revelation that that it could work out if you had them study at home. And so he had the curriculum of people fashion a curriculum that a student could study in the privacy of his or her own home and complete the assignments. And then they had a way for them to participate in a Super Saturday where you could bring clusters of these students together one day a week on a Saturday, and they would have activities as well as some teaching, and teacher could check on their work. And they asked a man who had taught in the church education system who had some ties to the Midwest, a man by the name of Don Bond, to go to the Midwest and to pilot this program and see how it would work. And he did, and sure enough, home study became a successful part of the church educational system where it was warranted. It's not quite as good as being able to meet together with your peers and be taught by a teacher, but it's certainly much better than not having any kind of religious instruction during the year. And this spread to places where it was needed. And then the church education system, the leaders, also received a mandate from the Board of Education that wherever the church went, the church education system would follow and would establish their programs. And I don't think you can overemphasize the value that a seminary and institute, in whatever form it took in these countries, has made in the lives of the students, because you have just many church leaders in these countries came out of people that had participated in seminary and institutes. So it's the leadership impact. I guess the most essential way in the church to become a really good leader is to understand the scriptures and the principles of the gospel, and seminary was a great aid in that. And many of those early people who took part in home study and daily seminary in countries like South America and Europe later became the bishops and the Relief Society presidents and the state presidents. And many of them were even called to be general authorities or leaders in the church education system.
Well, another thing that happened is when home study went worldwide, those who pioneered it in various countries were told that they were to find someone to replace them in 3 years. So their assignment was only for 3 years or less if it took less time. And so I think that's another way they've found some of these great leaders were some that took part. And Let me talk about some of the people that went over. They went without any monetary means from the church at first to these
countries.
And
this was to international
destinations. They paid their own way. They set up their own offices. Their families went with them. And this was quite a trial for some of these women. I remember reading about one woman that said that she was afraid to shop in the stores. Her husband was gone a lot, and they didn't have a car, and all of this was strange. She didn't understand the language. A great deal of sacrifice, but a lot of growth for these families that went on these assignments.
We're running out of time, and there's so much more we could talk about. But before we wrap it up, I would like to talk about teaching methods over the years, specifically conceptual versus scripture sequentially teaching. If you could describe that to our listeners and what the difference is and why the change.
Well, at the as the church as the seminaries and institutes began, there were individuals who were known for their writing skills who were asked to write textbooks for the various courses. Frank West himself wrote a book on the Old Testament. O.C. Tanner was asked to write a book on the New Testament. There were others that asked to write similar books. And so the scriptures were not the main emphasis. I mean, these books were about the scriptures, but you taught more what was in the book than you did actually from the scriptures, even though the scriptures were in the classroom. And then as over time and as the church spread, and especially when you had early morning teachers who had no college, many of them, or no teaching classes, You were training average church members. Then you had to have it was believed you had to have more helps, and so there the curriculum department began to develop aids for these teachers, and it was thought at this period of time that if you taught a concept like faith or repentance or morality, that one concept a day was about all a student could handle. And so if you got a student to understand that concept and then be able to teach that concept to someone else and then apply it in his life, you know, you've done a pretty good job. And some of the lesson manuals were really good, but they were quite large, lots of pages, and you had lots of ways you could teach. There were motivational items. There were games, crossword puzzles, a way to clinch things down, and gradually, as the church grew, some of the brethren, and I think even some in the church education system, began to worry about the size and the expense of all of this material. And so President Kimball, on one occasion, asked that all things be reduced, and so that they could put a growth or stop the growth of the number of pages and the expense of all this. And Brother Peterson, who was then the administrator of the church education of the seminaries and institutes, asked Dave Christensen and Gerald Lund and Jay Jensen were given the responsibility of coming up with a curriculum that could reduce the number of pages and cut the costs. They had a fairly vigorous discussion. You read their diaries. They talk about the animation that they have as they put forth different ideas, but at the end result, I think it's my belief that they received inspiration from
Heavenly Father, and they developed a curriculum that was sequential, that you're going to, instead of having a lesson manual on the Old Testament, you take the Old Testament to class, and the same with the New Testament, and you would teach blocks of Scripture sequentially. Now, it was called sequential teachings of the Scriptures, but it's obvious, you're not going to take a group of ninth graders and go through the book of Chronicles sequentially, everything. You know, there had to be some adjustments to this. And so this became the way that the curriculum was developed. And President Eyring, when he first became the Commissioner of Education, I can remember being in the meeting, in a meeting, I don't know if it was the meeting, where he talked about, he had this grand vision of seeing the young people bringing their Scriptures with them to class and opening the Scriptures and studying from the Scriptures. And I think there were some in the audience who weren't so sure that that would ever happen exactly that way. And but it did. And it improved the seminary of teaching experience and the students' experience. And then recently, in another bit of the fine-tuning of teaching the Scriptures sequentially, the student is not only asked to study the Scriptures and to become familiar with the Scriptures and know the Scriptures, but they also have a third dimension now, is that they are asked to be able to explain the Scripture to someone else and to explain the principles of the gospel to others, which is having a good impact on them. That it's something to know something about the Bible and something else entirely to be able to explain it to someone else. And so that's another aspect. But the church education system has always been concerned about application, you don't just get the student into the seminary and into the institute, but you get the seminary and the institute into the student, and that's been an essential element of all teaching in the church education system. And there's some wonderful examples where that has happened.
Good, thank you. One final question. Have qualifications for seminary institute teachers evolved over the past century? We have the original teachers, J. Wiley Sessions and Thomas J. Yates. Do teachers have to have a doctorate in philosophy and religion these days to be a teacher?
Our education leaders and the Church Board of Education is not as concerned about what a man or woman has their degree in as they are about their ability to teach and their faith in the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so, no, you can, if you're going to the college, and all release time or daily seminary teachers have to have a college degree to be hired. Early days of the seminaries and institutes, the leaders of the education system would sometimes go out and see someone that really impressed them. Maybe they would see them teach a Sunday school class or hear them give a talk and would recruit these individuals. For example, Elder Dean Larson, who became member of the 70s, he was a coach in Wyoming, and someone saw him and thought he was good with young people, and so they kind of recruited him, and he became an individual that taught seminary and then was influential in the Native American seminary of a program of the church. And but then, as the church education system grew, they established a training situation, started first at Brigham Young University. Leland Anderson, who was a grand old teacher in eastern Utah, Manti area, he was given the charge of training the seminary teachers. And so you'd have an experience where you had a methods class, then you did some student teaching, And then if you found out you liked it, and the kids liked you, and your supervisor or the people observed you liked it, then you'd be hired. As long as I can remember, there were always more people that wanted to teach than were hired, and so there was always a bit of competition to see that you got into the seminary, the program. And then teacher training centers were established at Utah State University, the University of Utah, Arizona, and other places. And then under Joe Christensen, when he was leading the church education system, he had developed what he called the OPT program, Outstanding Potential Teachers. And with this program, you received the pre-training that I talked about earlier, and then you were hired at a stipend, and you taught a full year in a daily seminary. And that has improved the quality, because by teaching longer, you find out whether you wear well and how the students are going to respond. And you also find out whether you like the seminary experience, the seminary teaching experience or not. And so so you do go through quite a rigorous training program. There's still more people that apply than each year than can be hired. And there were a lot of those that old veterans that were even considered to be fairly good at it, who wonder if they would be able to be hired today, because it's the competition may be a little stiffer than it used to be.
Sounds like the main qualification is personal conversion. Is that fair?
All teachers would have to have faith, but there are many wonderful people that have tremendous faith who still can't teach, and so there's an element of teaching that is an art as well as something that is learned, and you need a combination of a person okay. that has faith and also one that can relate to old Carl J. Mazur's advice to Mariner W. Merrill way back with the first seminary the teachers still holds true today. You have somebody that likes young people and can get the gospel into their hearts.
Very good. So we've been talking today with Kenneth and Audrey Godfrey, historians and co-authors of By Study and By Faith. As I understand it, this book is being written for the centennial of seminaries. Is that right?
Looks like it might turn out to be that way. I don't know if it was considered that in the beginning, but we're getting very, very close to the centennial.
Very good. I appreciate you being with us today.